Hey y'all, this is Scott Merrick from the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach bringing you Snacks for the Brain, episode number 59. This episode features a chat I was lucky enough to facilititate this past month, July 2007, between participants of a workshop I offered at my school, University School of Nashville, and educational change advocate and friend, David Warlick. David blogs an immensely popular site called 2 Cents Worth, and he hosts an educational podcast called Connect Learning.
See show notes for all links discussed in this podcast,
including one to the workshop's blog and wiki, which are rife with resources for learning about the use of valuable developing technologies in the service of our children's learning. David has some impressively interesting things to share. I particularly like his first quality of Web 2.0 education. Ready? Information is participatory and inclusive. Think about that for a minute, and if you're anything near my own age, think about how your own schooling may or may not stand up to that principle. And what about a second quality, the one that offers a place for teachers in this brave new world? Education is leader-directed. Or his third, that it's people-connecting. Listen to what David Warlick has to say about all of those qualities, and then draw your own opinions. Feel free to comment on the show notes page at blogs.vanderbilt.edu/s4b.
That's the numeral 4, by the way.
You'll hear about math students creating their own textbooks with wikis, about Vicki Davis's work with students in Georgia, and also about how social networking does the people-connecting part of the Web 2.0 equation. I brought a little music to the show in the form of a melody I worked out on a strum stick, a little 3-stringed instrument that was given to my son recently. It's called All About Me, and I hope you like that. I'm also sharing a little mandolin ditty of mine called Miranda and Emma Are in China, and I'll end the podcast with a song from a new compilation CD from Magnatune.com. The album's called The Art of Persuasion, and it's over-brimming with romantically seductive ear candy that is only available at Magnatune.com.
We are not evil.
The sound quality of the interaction is not the best, but it's what I call GE. No, not General Electric. Good enough. Thanks, Steve Bergen at the Harlem Storefront School in New York. This thing was recorded from the speakers on my Dell Inspiron laptop running Skype video and captured on my little flip video device. See that at theflip.com. Thanks for listening, and come on back for another snack soon. Without further ado, here's David Warlick.
Back to the textbook, because the textbook is always right. I want to go back to the newspaper, because the newspaper is always right.
Really?
Or is it? Is it?
The
Wikipedia really new? I mean, just got back from the conference in New Jersey, and what came up time and time again is the superintendents of textbooks were talking about today's information landscape, is that typically what you see in the history book is there because of the person who won. You know, it's the side who won is the side that gets to tell the history. You know, so this idea of being in an information landscape that we cannot rely on 100% is not new. In fact, I would pose the question. If the material in your textbook is not always 100% accurate, do they have a warning in that textbook that warns you that the information in this textbook may not be accurate 5 years from now? Do they have a warning? Does the New York Times have a warning? Does the Encyclopedia Britannica have a warning? You know, really, who seems more interested in helping you get access to the best information, the source that is willing to warn you that what's here may not be true, or the source that seems really more interested in protecting its own authority? which one seems most interested in giving you the best information?
Interesting.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it's an important question, one that we should think about. You know, what about the Wikipedia? What about the social silicon? This is a different kind of source of information where the content's coming from us, coming from a community of people. In slide number 10, there's the Wikipedia article for a musical instrument called the euphonium. This is a musical instrument that my son plays. And you could go to the Wikipedia article, type in euphonium, you could read all about it, the history of the euphonium, the type of music that it's played in. But if you were to scroll all the way down to the bottom, there's a section to the article that's recently been added where you can get, I think if we go to slide 11, you get a list of all of the universities, colleges and universities in the United States that offer a program in euphonium musicianship. And not only do you get the name of all the universities, you get the name of the person who teaches, the professor who teaches the euphonium. And you find out whether that teacher actually plays the euphonium, or maybe plays the tuba, or plays the trombone. Now the point I'll make is, you wouldn't find that kind of information in the Encyclopedia Britannica. You wouldn't find that kind of information in the Encyclopedia Britannica, because what you do find in the Encyclopedia Britannica is there because of a group of very smart people who decided on what was the very best, most valuable information to be made available to the largest denominator of readers. That's what you find in the Encyclopedia Britannica. What we find in this article right here is there because of a community of people who love the euphonium. You know, there are people who have, in a sense, adopted this article, and they care about the euphonium, they care about this article. If anybody changes the article, they automatically get an email message telling them this article just got changed. They're going there to see if what it got changed to is accurate or not. If not, they reverse it. Okay? It's a different source of information. If you go back to your school, to the science textbook in your school, and you look up the astronomy chapter, you go to the solar system, how many planets do this one tell you are in the solar system?
Absolutely.
Now, if I were doing this face to face, I would pull out the BBC article that was published that talks about the current 8 planets of the solar system. I would show you that article was published on a minute after the announcement came out of Prague, where the astronomers were rewriting the qualifications of a planet, and where Pluto no longer qualified to be a planet. And then I would pull up a Wikipedia article for the solar system, which describes the 8 planets, the 4 inner planets, the 4 outer planets of the solar system. And I would be able to show you that article in the Wikipedia was published less than a minute after the BBC article came out.
Well,
it took less than a minute for the Wikipedia to be up to date. Now, the point I want to make is that there are things that the Wikipedia are much better at than the more traditional vetted sources of information. There are things that the Encyclopedia and similar sources of information are much better at than the Wikipedia. I would not be able to cite that Wikipedia article for a major report. Okay, that's its weakness. It's more authoritative. That's its weakness. Its strength is that I'm going to find more up-to-date information in the Wikipedia. I'm going to find richer content in the Wikipedia. Okay? I'm going to find more authoritative content in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Our job is not to teach our children what to read and what not to read. Our job is to teach them how to make that decision. It's to teach them how
could
to
you decide. Repeat that?
Our job is not to teach our students what to read and what not to read. It is to teach them how to make a decision. When is it appropriate to use a social source of information to solve your problem? And when is it appropriate to use a very traditional source of information to solve your problem? We've got to teach them how to make that decision.
Thank you.
How do we do that?
Oh. You ready for questions here?
Sure.
Caroline Blackwell asked, how do we do that?
What's the criteria for when is the right time to use either source?
Well, you start that in the conversation. Let me give you an example. If I were teaching fifth grade, I would allow my students to use the Wikipedia as a source of information. But there would always be two parts of the assignment. Part one of the assignment would be go look at the Wikipedia, go learn what the Wikipedia says about this topic that you're getting ready to write a report on, or that you're interested in. Go learn what the Wikipedia says, okay? Part two of the assignment is not prove that what's in the Wikipedia is true. Okay? Now, the proof may be in the Wikipedia. The proof may be in fact three of the candidates. The proof may be in some papers or some professor wrote at some college, you know, 10 years ago. But when you talk about that, when you talk about what they learned, you talk about the proof of it. You talk about the evidence that this is true. It is not just this is what the Wikipedia says, or this is what Encyclopedia Britannica says. But part of that conversation has got to be why this is true in the Encyclopedia Britannica, why this is true from the professor, why this is true from the Wikipedia. That has to be part of the conversation. It's not something that you can really teach in a single assignment. It's not something that you teach in the fifth grade, you know, right, and then let it carry through. It has got to be a part of conversation every day in your classroom. If I'm teaching history again, and my students turn in a paper, they would be accustomed, they would be ready for me to ask at any moment about points of one paragraph in that paper, mm-hmm, about points of one bullet in a presentation that they're doing. They would be accustomed to me being able to point to that bullet and say, how do you know that that's true? And if they can't answer that question, even if it is true, if they cannot give me evidence that it's true, then they're going to lose points, even if it is true. Because it's not a matter of teaching them how to validate the information. It's a matter of getting them in the habit of validating information. You and I were taught to assume the authority of the information that we encountered. It's in what we were taught, it's in how we were taught. Now, if it came to you in a book, a magazine, whatever, we assumed that it was true. That's what we were taught. We have to stop teaching children to assume the authority of the content that they encounter. We must instead teach them to prove the authority. And it's not just a matter of teaching that skill, it is a habit that they have to get in. They will be able to challenge me at any time. If I'm lecturing about history, any student at any time will be able to say, but Mr. Willis, how do you know that that's true? And if I can't answer that question, I lose points. If I can't answer that question, then I'm not doing my job. Does that make sense?
And without going too deep, at what point do you decide or do you allow a child to say this is true after verification in three different sources or four different sources, for example, in history?
The question is, without, you know, going too deep, at what point do you accept the veracity of the authenticity of information? Is it after two sources, three sources?
Our tendency as teachers is to want to have a checklist, because that's what we teach, it's the way that we teach. It depends entirely on the source, it depends entirely on the nature of the assignment.
Okay.
And the content.
And the content, yes, absolutely. The, I think that we have to reshape our assignments. We can't ask students to write reports about George Washington anymore. You know, we need to ask them to write reports that are making a point, such as you write a report that compares George Washington with Nelson Mandela. Okay? What are the qualities that they had alike? All right? And then the question, and so that there's a goal to the assignment. The assignment is not just to prove that you've mastered this skill or to prove that you've mastered these facts. But I think the assignment has to be, you know, has to have a perceived audience in mind, a perceived goal in mind. I want you to write a report that supports this position. I want you to write a report that we're going to pretend that we're going to assemble the president of the United States or the county commissioners, or I want you to write this letter, and we're going to literally send it to a senior citizen community down the west. You know, or we're going to put it out on the internet. And so there's going to be a real audience. And I want you to write this letter or this report to convince people to vote this way, or to help people know this story or whatever. Hmm. And then if there's a goal and objective to the assignment, then that goal and objective becomes the purpose. meaning of validity. Does this source help you accomplish that goal? Okay? If the source is not true, if the source is flaky, if the source is not going to be reliable 2 months from now or 2 days from now, then it doesn't help you accomplish the goal. I think that's what the goal is. That's not just a rule, but we have to ask the right question. I am writing to communicate. I communicate to accomplish a goal. Our assignments have to be that way. Like, it can't just be writing assignments, but they have to be communication assignments.
Authentic assignments with goals that will lead to assessment or evaluation.
Assignment. And you know, I've never had that happen before. Why am there begging me for writing assignments. And I think that what happens is when kids are participating in the information experience, when kids are blogging, it stops being a writing assignment and it starts being a communications assignment. Because they aren't writing just to the teacher and what they think the teacher wants to read. They're writing knowing that at least their classmates, if not people at the book, at least their classmates are going to be reading what they're writing and responding to what they're writing through the comments. So it stops being a mere writing assignment and starts being a communication assignment. And I think that's what kids need to be doing, is not just writing, but communicating. This final teacher said, now this was interesting, this teacher said, without a doubt, the children who find their voices first and carry the most enthusiasm for bullying are my special needs kids. Because what this participatory, this sense of participating in the information landscape does for you is that it empowers you. Okay, it is giving voice to what you've learned, it's giving voice to what you know, it's giving voice to your experience. And it makes sense that the people who would respond to this most would be those who are least likely to have that empowerment. You know, those kids are least likely to feel any sense of empowerment in the classroom. You give them gloves and you give them the ability to submit their voice to the world or to the rest of the class. You know, that's hugely empowering. It can be life-changing to some of these kids. Wikis are another one. If you haven't learned about Wikis already, you will. Let me just, I'm on slide 16 here. You'll see a picture of staff at textbooks. This is a math classroom that I walked into 7 months ago in New Brunswick, Canada. And these are the textbooks, and from all of the dust all over the book, it is obvious that the books have not been used in a very long time, because the math teacher is now building his own textbook on a wiki. Now, there's not a whole lot of writing in the textbook. Basically, he's written just a little description of whatever kinds of problems they're going to be learning or whatever topics that they're going through. But most of it, he's got a little tablet PC, and he will record his demonstrations of the different kinds of problems that they're going to be having, and he's able to record those as a video, and he can embed those videos into the wiki pages. He also has the students' worksheets. And so the students come into the classroom at the laptop school, students come into the classroom, they go to the wiki page, they download the worksheet, they watch Handy do the little demonstration at the first of the class, and then they start their work. And if they have any questions, they need to ask him over, they're going to pull up one of those little videos and see it. And they go home, they pull up one of those little videos and see how he solved the problem. You know, and what's particularly useful to him for this is the fact that if this class has a particular problem with a certain type, certain topic, or a certain type of mathematical concept, if they have a problem with it, then all he has to do is go on and rewrite some part of that chapter. You know, so he clarifies it, he adds some text, he takes some text up, he puts another demonstration in. You know, the textbook becomes a conversation between the teacher and the class. The textbook becomes a conversation between the curriculum and the class and the learner. Okay, because it's in a wiki, he has complete power over, and in some cases, the students have power over.
Well,
the second stage, the second wiki there, is written by Vicki Davis. She's a computer science teacher in Georgia. She used to, at the beginning of the class, she used to say, I want you to write a report about word processing. I want you to write a report about quantum computing. I want you to write a report about word processing. I want you to write the chapter on word processing. I want you to write the chapter on virtual reality. I want you to write the chapter on quantum computing. And I write the chapters in a wiki. So literally, the class is writing the same textbook, which they use to study for their test. I asked her a while back, if you find a problem that links over the textbook, do you fix it? She said, no. She said, I wait for the students to find the problem. I want them to be responsible for the quality of the content that they're going to use to store it for the test. And she said, no, if it's going out of the line and there's something that's wrong in there, she'll point it out to somebody and ask them to fix it. But as a general rule, they are responsible for their own information quality. So that's a wiki. I'm going to skip on over to slide,
Thank you. Yeah, we don't want to take too much of your time, and I just passed over that long tail page that I want to get back to later, like later in the week.
Okay.
So,
well, can I move on, or do you have something else going on at 3?
Actually, we're going to break out around 2 o'clock our time, 3 o'clock your time. We can go a few more minutes. I think it'd be nice maybe to move to any questions, maybe some of those that were provided in the chat text. I don't want to cut you short.
Okay,
if you've got a closer, go for it.
Yeah, let me just go through very, very quickly and go on to the slide 24, where the second quality of information is that it's reader-directed. Essentially, we can train information to find us today. Y'all probably be looking at RSS and aggregators. And when I do this as a demonstration, I typically have teachers on the edges of their seats. In fact, I had a librarian a while back jump up out of her chair and start speaking in tongues.
Uh-oh. We've got one in the room, so be gentle.
Okay. But I'm going to leave that up to you, Scott. But just that we are directing our information experience in ways that we never could before. And skipping on over to slide 30, the third quality is that it's people connecting. Scott and I met online, but we didn't meet because we live in the same place. We didn't meet because we live alike. We didn't meet because, we both enjoy music or whatever. We met because of our idea. We met because he somehow connected to me through my idea, or I somehow connected to him through his life, through his idea. So we now live in an information landscape where people all over the world are connecting to each other through their blogs, but they're not connecting because of who they are, they're connecting because of what they think. They're connecting because of the ideas that they share. So we have communities of people from all over the world who are forming around a certain topic and able to help each other become experts. And I have this community of people that read my blog, whose blogs I read, who engage in conversation, and they help me do my job. But they live all over the world. And I have no reason to connect with them except through their ideas. So that's the third quality, is that we live in an information landscape where people connect to each other through their ideas.
Wow, indeed. Thank you, David Warlick, for connecting with us at our workshop Web 2.0 for us at University School of Nashville in late July 2007. I benefit from chatting with you anytime I can. My teachers universally express to me that they learn from our connection, and I hope our listeners feel as glad for your sharing as I do. Thanks again. Hey, I'm walking y'all out with a lovely version of a traditional folk song all done up in electronica by New England songstress Lisa De Benedictis from Magnatune.com. You've heard her before on Snacks for the Brain, and I dare say you'll hear her again when you tune in for another episode. Hey, next time it's number 60.
Yippee! 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 Snacks for the Brain is brought to you by the fine folks at the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at scienceoutreach.org.
The cuckoo, she's a funny bird, singing as she flies. She'll bring you glad tidings, tell you no lies. She sips from pretty flowers to make voice clear, and she'll never sing cuckoo till the spring of the year.
Three.